contented and happy as a slave. Groups of touring minstrels were indeed common in England by 1860, entertaining large audiences with exaggerated dialects and grotesque caricature. A Newcastle paper reported that Douglas experienced personal hostility to his color as never before, and that in a speech he condemned both American ministers as well as the minstrels alike for pouring the leprous distillment of their pro-slavery poison into the ears and hearts of the British people. British abolition dearly needed a revival. For at least a brief time, Douglas gave it his voice and energy. In January 1860, while Douglas was in England, Ottilie Assing's German translation of My Bondage and My Freedom appeared. According to her biographer, Maria Dietrich, Assing sought to invent a Douglas that was all hers. Indeed, that was the case. Although with only the slimmest evidence via a third-party source, Dietrich maintains that Assing plans to join Douglas for a secret romantic holiday in France. Douglas did seek to travel to France by his own account, but could not go because the American government denied him a passport. Douglas openly blamed the racism of the Democratic Party's minister to the court of St. James's, George Dallas. Assing may have dreamed of joining Douglas on his new European career, as Dietrich suggests, but nothing from Douglas's hand or voice ever indicated such intentions. Assing's designs on Douglas's heart and career come to us entirely by her own telling of the tale. All he later admitted to was a long-cherished desire to visit France. That he and Assing conducted an on-and-off intimate and important relationship seems certain from Assing's letters. It appears that Douglas had begun to study German at Assing's behest. Assing was utterly infatuated with Douglas and saw him as a romantic hero as well as, according to Dietrich, the legitimate heir of John Brown to lead the anti-slavery revolution. Assing's breathless hagiography of Brown and Douglas in the wake of Harper's Ferry knew no bounds. Dietrich rightly declares that Assing feared neither contradiction nor inconsistency in her writing. Her hopes and grandiosity halted abruptly, however, as did Douglas's second British sojourn, when news arrived in early spring while he was visiting Glasgow that his daughter, Annie, just short of her 11th birthday, had died in Rochester on March 13th, 1860, of an extended illness. A grief and guilt-stricken Douglas made haste to sail home to the United States, despite lingering concerns over his legal fate. He may have received the news of Annie's death from Rosetta, who was now an occasional correspondent with her father. Annie herself had written the faraway parent in December 1859, telling of her joys and successes in school, especially her German lessons. "I am the first reader, and I can read," she told the exiled Douglas. Assing had taken a sincere interest in the education of Douglas's daughters. Anna Douglas was devastated by the loss of her namesake and final child of her marriage to the peripatetic world citizen she had once known as the lonely and ambitious boy from the Baltimore docks. A letter from Rosetta to Douglas's adopted sister, Harriet Ruth Adams, opens a small window into Anna's bleak but courageous bereavement. "I have just asked Mother what I should say for her," said Rosetta to Harriet. "She sends her love to you and thanks you as heartily as myself for your sympathizing letter. And as she is unable to write, will allow my letter to be in answer for both. She is not very well now, being quite feeble, though, about the house." Then Anna asked her daughter to tell Anna's sister-in-law to politely, if you desire, write to her famous brother and tell him to come home to Rochester. Along with her adult daughter and teenage sons, Anna would have seen to the burial of Annie. How horribly conspicuous Douglas must have seemed to all of them by his absence. 35 carriages rolled along Rochester streets and roads to Annie's burial, according to a report in Douglas's Monthly. The disease was one of the brain that had baffled the doctors. During the funeral observances, wrote the Observer, frequent allusions were made to the father of little Annie, so far away, who would be so sad to be present, and yet more sad to be absent. Douglas wrote few public words about his daughter's death. He later called Annie the light and life of my house. As he rode the trains from Glasgow to Halifax, said goodbye to Julia and Henry Crofts, then hurried on to Liverpool, his lonely burden numbed him. The cheering had stopped. Those huge and engaging audiences in the ornate halls of Edinburgh and Glasgow were suddenly a world away from his personal reality. The helpless, self-made man headed home to face events he could not control. In one of Rosetta's letters to Harriet, she told of receiving letters from her father, which do not survive, indicating that his grief was great, and hoping for another message with more composure of mind. Douglas took a steamer to Portland, Maine, remaining inconspicuous as he returned to Rochester via Canada. After a 17-day voyage, he was home by late April, where he would remain off the lecture circuit for nearly 4 months, still wary of the Senate investigation, and doing his best to help Anna grieve and to provide a father's presence for Annie's 4 siblings. The youngest son, Charles, reminiscing many years later, said this sequence of events left them all a dismembered family. Thus, at the age of 16, he wrote, "I left my father's house, never to return again, only as a visitor." They needed him. In a public letter to his British anti-slavery friends of May 26, 1860, Douglas told of his sorrow-stricken family and how his presence felt sacredly beneficial. But then he all but politicized Annie's death, thanking his English friends for their sympathy and suggesting that her demise resulted from over-anxiety for the safety of her father and deep sorrow for the death of dear old John Brown, upon whose knee she had often sat only a few months before. All of this tenderness of sentiment and memory presaged Douglas's appeal about the never-ending problem of receipts and expenses of his newspaper. The Douglas's Monthly was broke again. Political anti-slavery desperately needed his voice, and he enticed his British network with the news that 10 more fugitive slaves had passed under his own roof in the mere month he had resided back in Rochester. The public letter was a common genre in this era, but rarely had Douglas or anyone else in his abolitionist orbit mixed such private sorrow with fundraising. In July of 1860, Otterly Ossing came for a somewhat extended visit to Rochester, where, among other activities, she took an oath of allegiance to the United States and became an American citizen. According to her biographer, she tried hard during this time to persuade Douglas away from his religious faith and biblical literary voice, but to no avail. Ossing often had exquisitely bad timing and judgment. Whatever else they shared in affection and ideas, her atheism and his Christian worldview and millennial sense of history clashed, ultimately, fatally. Douglas had planned a return visit to Britain that September to resume his effort to revive British abolitionism, but called it off because of the American presidential election campaign and his desire to effect it. "He who speaks now," he wrote in the Monthly, "may have an audience. We wish to strike while the iron is hot." He further expressed great confidence in his ever faithful friend and coadjutor, Mrs. Dr. Crofts, in forging a new anti-slavery sentiment in Great Britain. Moreover, Douglas continued to clash openly with Garrisonians, exchanging nasty counter-accusations in October and November over whether he sought the demise of the American Anti-Slavery Society, which he vehemently denied. During this season of intense public furor in the land, he and Garrison made sure not to appear in the same physical space. Douglas also found time in late September to attend a 7th annual clam bake, a large social gathering of free African Americans held that year in Fort Lee, New Jersey, on the Hudson River. Conceived by the New Yorker Peter A. Williams in 1853, this grand rural banquet drew people to days of entertainment and reunion from Boston, Newport, Providence, New York, Philadelphia, Hartford, and other towns. After a feast at Fort Lee, speeches were made, and Douglas, as usual, was front and center. The Anglo-African reported that as guests found their places, a form arises, towering head and shoulders over the whole company. It is Frederick Douglass, thenceforth, as ever, the lion of the occasion. Douglass knew how to work a crowd. In his own report on the occasion, he maintained that his people should never lose their heart for amusement. We like to study our people at play as well as at prayer. Soon they were back to work that needed their prayers. That summer and fall of 1860, Douglass threw himself back into his journalism and into the most transformative election in the nation's history. Hope and principles were at war, and even serving each other as never before. Since the Democrats tore themselves into two sectionalized parts, one supporting Stephen A. Douglas for president, and the other John C. Breckinridge of Kentucky, and since the Republicans' nomination of Abraham Lincoln, who despite being apparently more moderate than his chief rival, William H. Seward, threatened the South in unprecedented ways, Douglas felt inspired by the pending election campaign. Assuming his election year pose, he girded up for another walk along the thin line between endorsement and denunciation of Republicans. The Republican Party, he told his British friends, is only negatively anti-slavery. It is opposed to the political power of slavery, rather than to slavery itself. But it possessed what no previous political force had, because it could humble the slave power and defeat all plans for giving slavery any further guarantees of permanence. Douglass promised to work for the Republicans even as he expressed contradictory cautions. Despite being disappointed by the Chicago platform in a June 1860 editorial, he praised Lincoln. Untried, and without claim to any literary culture beyond the circle of his practical duties, the Illinois lawyer was nevertheless honest, possessed a well-balanced head, and great firmness of will. Douglass decided that Republicans really did nominate, in Lincoln, a radical fully committed to the doctrine of the irrepressible conflict. Although Douglass regretted the Republicans' lack of moral abolitionism and would have preferred the brave and inspiring march of a storming party, in its absence, he would settle for the slow process of a cautious siege. It was the political season indeed, and Douglass had never known a political persuasion that he could not both cheer and attack, depending on the audience and purpose. His observations about Lincoln proved astute in the long run. At this tense juncture, however, Douglass tilted in political crosswinds. On July 2nd, he wrote in a confused tone to Gerrit Smith, who struggled with a mental breakdown in the wake of Harper's Ferry. "I cannot support Lincoln," Douglass asserted, "but whether there is life enough in the abolitionists, Radical Abolition Party, to name a candidate, I cannot say. I shall look to your letter for light on the pathway of duty." Then in August, Douglass wrote in the Monthly that the vital element of the Republican Party was its anti-slavery sentiment. Nothing is plainer, Douglass argued, than that the Republican Party has its source in the old Liberty Party. It would live or die, he contended, as the abolition sentiment of the country flourishes or fades. Vexed by his commitments to moral principle and political action, Douglass announced that he would vote for what historian Richard Sewall rightly called the remnant of Gerrit Smith's minuscule radical party, while assiduously working for Lincoln's election. Douglass's political fluctuations in 1860 were hardly unique. His public editorials were the searching efforts of a black leader to comprehend an amalgam of political interests and a party that seemed to both despise and champion his people. The American party system was undergoing a revolution, and the nation now teetered on the brink of a potential disunion that both worried and thrilled Douglass. His political positions in 1860, as in 1856, reflected a personality trait historian James Oakes has called impulsive and voluble, a tendency to sharp reversals as he rushed his ideas into print each month in his paper. But Douglass's critiques of Lincoln and the Republicans were less rushed than representative of his lack of leverage and his isolation outside of the party's inner circles. The only prominent Republican with whom Douglas had any regular correspondence was Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner, whom Douglas deeply admired as a radical, the Wilberforce of America, with a daring and nerve to denounce the barbarism of slavery on the floor of the Senate. Sumner was what Douglas wished the Republican Party would become, a force that would grapple with the hell-born monster itself. But he knew it was a coalition of interests, and he found an uncomfortable foothold among some of its guiding ideas, especially the denationalization of slavery, a theory advanced most prominently by Salmon P. Chase that sought to turn slavery in upon itself, where it would suffocate and die. Wherever federal jurisdiction existed, the District of Columbia, the territories, foreign and interstate commerce, the Postal Service, the Fugitive Slave Act, Republicans would either deny slavery protection or attack it. Douglas saw this variation on non-extensionism as merely the first step in a constitutional plan to restrict slavery geographically and then ultimately to eradicate it by federal action. He absolutely disagreed with Lincoln's and the Republicans' idea that they could not constitutionally end slavery in the states where it already legally existed. Douglas had been arguing the opposite for nearly a decade. "It will be a great work accomplished," a newly encouraged Douglas wrote in June, "when this government is divorced from the active support of the inhuman slave system." He wanted to turn the tide of the national administration against the man-stealers of this country. Thus, Douglas found his own way to fold radical rhetoric into moderate methods, and, at least most of the time, sing hosannas to the Republicans. Excited and wary, Douglas did not merely await election returns in the fall of 1860. In the 3,200 words of editorials and the 7,000 words of a major speech on the West Indian Emancipation Anniversary in August alone, Douglas delivered a remarkably astute political analysis of the 1860 election, a journalist's first draft of history, if ever there was one. With informed precision and a propagandist's zeal, Douglas depicted the Republican coalition's diverse attitudes toward slavery in five parts. 1. Because it was an expensive and wasteful system of labor. 2. Because it created an aristocratic class who despised labor, which in turn led to a broader contempt for all others who work for an honest living. 3. Because a small southern oligarchy had become masters of the United States and the governing class of the nation's institutions. 4. Because it led some whites with an aversion to blacks to deny them all rights and liberties and to exclude them from new territories. And 5. Because the genuine abolition element saw slavery as the most atrocious and revolting crime against nature and nature's God, a system of inhumanity to be destroyed out of a mighty conviction. The only group missing from Douglas's characterization of the Republican coalition were the nativists, the former know-nothing, anti-immigrant, Protestant white northerners who had made huge inroads into American politics in the early 1850s. By 1860, they too found a place under the Republicans' broad tent. Douglas gloated over the splitting of the Democrats into Northern and Southern factions. "The Democrats," argued Douglas, "had historically surpassed all others in heartless cruelty toward blacks. Their division now opened a floodgate for the Republican waters to rush through, and he sent up a jubilee shout over the fact that the wisdom of the crafty had been confounded, the counsels of the wicked brought to naught." But in a different mood, in the same brief period, the enthusiastic political junkie turned into a dark moral philosopher. Douglas knew the political calculus indicated that Lincoln and the Republicans would win in November, but the previous decade had taught him not to trust the American national character. For his people, slavery had always been experienced as grim and bloody tragedies, rehearsed day by day. But most Americans, including Northerners about to vote Republican, were but spectators in a theater watching the slavery crisis as a grand operatic performance. Americans, Douglas believed, instinctively and culturally watched history and preferred not to act in it. Douglas summed up his bitter complaint as this terrible paradox of passing history rooted in a distinctively American selfishness. Whoever levies a tax upon our bohe or young hyson, two forms of Chinese tea, will find the whole land blazing with patriotism and bristling with bayonets. If some foreign power tried to impress a few Yankee sailors, Americans would go fight like heroes. Douglas fashioned a withering chastisement of American self-centeredness that would match any modern complaint about the culture's hyper-individualism. Millions of a foreign race may be stolen from their homes and reduced to hopeless and inhuman bondage among us, he complained, and we either approve the deed or protest as gently as sucking doves. His wickedly selfish Americans loved to celebrate their own heritage, and on this condition are content to see others crushed in our midst. They lived by the philosophy of Cain, ready with their bluntly evil answer to the famous question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Douglas's use of the Cain and Abel parable is all the more telling if we remember that, unlike the more sentimental ways the brother's keeper language is often employed today, Cain had just killed his brother, and to God's query as to Abel's fate, Cain replies in effect, "Why should I care?" Douglas wanted the indifferent Americans, with blood on their hands as well, to read on further in Genesis and know Cain's fate as a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth. On the eve of such a new and encouraging election, Douglas's gloom seems odd at first glance. But this radical was still trying to comprehend just how to be a Republican. His writings were the reflections of a hardened abolitionist, not certain whether the impending political collisions augured the liberation or the sacrificial doom of his people. The cynic in Douglas left him saying, "Heaven help the poor slave, whose only hope for freedom is in the selfish hearts of such a people." But the radical pragmatist kept one eye trained on just how to apply that American self-interestedness to the cause of abolition. That fall, Douglas never found peace on either side of his self-imposed divide between pure abolition and anti-slavery politics. Personally, he threw his vote away in 1860. Then, as a social reformer, he prepared to help push the new anti-Southern, anti-slavery politics along the course of abolition. In an August 1860 speech, he tried to clarify his position. "I would gladly have a party openly combined to put down slavery at the South. In the absence of such a party, I am glad to see a party in the field against which all that is slaveholding, malignant, and Negro-hating, both in the North and the South, is combined. Whatever aroused the ire of the slave power was the friend of the slave." "The slaveholders know that the day of their power is over," Douglas declared, "when a Republican president is elected." At the very least, Southern fears of Lincoln's potential victory served as tolerable endorsements of the anti-slavery tendencies of the Republican Party. More than anything else, the editor wanted to hasten a decisive conflict, a rupture in the body politic that would force everyone to be taught by the events. On Election Day, November 6, 1860, Douglas was in Rochester, working from morning until night at the polls. His most immediate concern was a proposal on the New York State ballot to abolish the $250 property requirement for black voters. No such requirement existed for whites. This movement for equal suffrage had attracted the racist scorn of Democrats and only limited endorsement from Republicans. But for black leaders, it was the object of a vigorous campaign. Coordinated from Albany by the black lobbyist and Underground Railroad activist Stephen A. Myers, and from New York City by McCune Smith, Douglas managed Western New York efforts. The campaign distributed thousands of copies of a tract, "The Suffrage Question in Relation to Colored Voters in the State of New York." The effort also created dozens of local suffrage clubs and auxiliaries of their New York State Suffrage Association, with some 56 in New York City and Brooklyn alone. In the 2 months before the election, Douglas barnstormed Western New York and distributed 25,000 copies of the tract. A constitutional amendment providing equal suffrage had passed the New York legislature in 1857, but was never brought to a referendum. In 1860, The measure reemerged with almost unanimous Republican support and solid Democratic opposition. In the campaign, however, most Republican newspapers and speakers quietly ignored or opposed the referendum, fearing that it might hurt Lincoln's chances of winning the state. In October, Douglas wrote a brilliant editorial lambasting Republican papers such as the New York World that denounced equal suffrage on the grounds that it caused blacks and whites to be intermingled in the same community. This position was not merely mean and base and a gross injustice, but ultimately lacked saneness, said the Rye editor. The World was at least largely honest with its racism. But in a passage that would fit perfectly into an early 21st century American debate over voter suppression measures, Douglas forcefully asked, "What is the World afraid of? Does it fear that with equal protection, Negro blood would prove more than a match for Anglo-Saxon blood in the race of improvement? Does it apprehend the departure of the reins of government out of the hands of the white race, and for this reason is in favor of continuing extra weight and an additional disability upon the Negro?" Douglas worked exhaustively for equal voting rights that autumn, but the result left him bitter and disillusioned. While Lincoln carried New York by 50,000 votes, the suffrage measure met a resounding defeat. 337,985 to 197,503. What Republican legislators had enacted, they treated with disdain at the polls. It was proof of Douglas's august reflections on American selfish individualism in the face of basic human rights. A large number of Republican voters had simply abstained on black suffrage as they voted for Lincoln. Douglas felt betrayed by Republican silence on the suffrage issue. The blow is a heavy and damaging one. Every intelligent colored man must feel it keenly. The defeat cut to the bone with its message of black political powerlessness. "We do not even wring from this vote the poor consolation that anybody was afraid of our influence or power," Douglas lamented. "The victory over us is simply one of blind ignorance and prejudice." The man who believed he could somehow change history by his pen, his voice, and now his vote, felt inaudible. But as before, Douglas converted the election of Lincoln and the threats of secession from the Deep South into a performance of his duty of hope, albeit a hope tinged with anger and exhausted cynicism. By December, from his Rochester desk, an ambivalent Douglas gave his best interpretation of the meaning of the election. Despite carrying only approximately 40% of the total vote, Lincoln's victory in the four-way sectionalized contest had altered the balance of power in America. But to what end, no one could yet know, especially a black editor in his Western New York outpost. The Republicans' rise to federal power might discredit the Fugitive Slave Act as well as extinguish the South's efforts to revive the foreign slave trade, Douglas posited. Abolitionist ideas had been thoroughly disseminated by the campaign, he reasoned, and therefore the chief benefit may simply have been the canvas itself. Lincoln's election had at least broken the enchantment too many Northern politicians had felt toward the slave power. A new political force had finally ended the perpetual bondage to an ignoble fear. But these were hardly celebratory words for the victors of 1860. In the immediate wake of the election, Douglas hedged all of his bets. On the eve of South Carolina's secession, Douglas was not convinced that enough radical disposition existed on either side to cause an open split, especially one that would lead to war. He reprinted nearly three full pages of reactions from Southern newspapers, what he called Southern thunder, but interpreted it as largely bluster. Despite all the secessionist rhetoric, he contended that the South had overreacted to Lincoln's threat and misinterpreted his intentions. Because of his high office and essential moderation, Douglas argued, Lincoln could even become the abolition movement's most powerful enemy. Disappointingly, Douglas saw no sufficient cause for the dissolution of the Union. Indeed, he feared that the Union might now be saved through compromises for all the wrong reasons, thus blunting, if not destroying, the abolitionists' voice and leverage. Although slaveholders might not realize it, Douglass predicted that slavery would be as safe and safer in the Union under such a president, Lincoln, than it can be under any president of a Southern Confederacy. Under the stress and strain of just what secession would mean, amid days and weeks of great confusion over what a silent Lincoln would do, Douglass argued that the election had taught the country the possibility of electing, if not an abolitionist, at least an anti-slavery reputation to the presidency of the United States. While the editor possessed the pen, voice, and influence of only one man, he would stay his course and join in no cry less than the complete and universal abolition of the whole slave system. Douglass took solace from simply wielding his pen in the service of the old cause, as he awoke every day for the news in a crisis like no other. Douglass found little encouragement in the behavior of the Northern public during the secession crisis. The bulk of white Northerners had always viewed abolitionists with suspicion or contempt, and with the threat of disunion in the air, hostility to anti-slavery agitators rose to new levels of violence. By December 1860, Northern working men, along with merchants, ship owners, and cotton manufacturers, were deeply worried about the impact of potential disunion, while bankers and industrialists squirmed as the prices of stocks declined markedly. The specter of financial ruin caused the spirit of political reconciliation to revive, and the conservative and the democratic press teemed with pro-compromise sentiment, as well as incendiary attacks on abolitionists. While Southern state conventions debated secession, mob violence against anti-slavery speakers raged in several Northern cities in the first 2 months of 1861. A revolution was afoot, but no one quite knew its course or consequences. Abolitionists provided ready scapegoats for mobs engulfed by economic and political panic. Douglass and many of his comrades faced just such a mob in force on December 3rd, 1860, at a gathering in Tremont Temple in Boston called to commemorate the first anniversary of the execution of John Brown. Freed from the remoteness of his editor's desk, Douglass seemed to welcome a fight, verbal or otherwise. That is exactly what he got. As the abolitionists gathered to address the broad topic of how can American slavery be abolished, a well-dressed crowd, what Douglass called a gentleman's mob, quickly outnumbered them and physically overtook the platform. For 3 hours, this daytime meeting was nothing less than a shouting, chaotic melee, complete with insults and epithets of all kinds, fisticuffs, chairs smashed and thrown, a swaying battle for control of the hall by the two competing sides. Eventually, the Boston police took over and forced a clearing of the building. At the center of the fight for the abolitionists was Douglass, coat removed, sleeves rolled up, and in full angry voice returning nearly every insult with one of his own. First, James Redpath and then Franklin Sanborn tried to exercise control as chairman, but they were shouted away by what Boston and New York reporters called the Unionists, who hijacked the meeting. Amid great confusion and noise, Douglass, invited as a featured speaker, frequently interrupted the mob's chairman, a Richard S. Fay. When Fay complained that he could not make himself heard over the tumult, Douglass warmed to the game by shouting, "When thine enemy thirst, give him drink," to applause and hisses. The Unionists put forward a series of anti-John Brown resolutions, to which Douglass again led the resistance, with some of the abolitionists now standing on their chairs, fists raised, and calling on their champion, Douglass, to speak. Shouts of, "Douglass! Douglass!" rang out around the temple. The orator, who had both endured and enjoyed these violent rituals before, demanded the floor with a voice all apparently could hear, prompting Fay's partisans to yet louder screams of, "Nigger! Knock him down!" and "Treason!" For a few minutes, Douglass managed some coherent statements as he shouted down his opponents with, "You are in the service of the slaveholders of the United States. It is said the best way to abolish slavery is to obey the law. Shall we obey the bloodhounds of the law who do the dirty work of the slave catchers?" Douglass gave as he took. With disturbances breaking out all over the hall throughout this bizarre struggle, Douglas fought for the podium, at one point pushing his way through a line of men and fighting, said one Boston reporter, like a trained pugilist. He even fought with one man for possession of a chair in which to sit. But Douglas fought most the battle of words. He asked the gathering to cast aside with indignation the wild and guilty fantasy that man owns property in man, even in that stout, big-fisted fellow down there who has just insulted me. As someone shouted, "Go on, nigger," Douglas answered from Exodus, "The freedom of all mankind was written on the heart by the finger of God." Then from the sublime to the ridiculous, he screamed at another heckler, "If I was a slave driver and had hold of that man for 5 minutes, I would let more daylight through his skin than ever got there before." These hateful exchanges, however relished by the combatants, ended in pushing, shoving, and fists thrown wildly, coats torn off. One group dragged Douglas down by his hair, or his wool, as reported, until a group of his friends rescued and protected him. Only the police could end such madness, but not before Douglas, who so defended his dignity and pride from even the smallest of slights, proclaimed that he felt no more embarrassment by this uproar than if I had been kicked by a jackass. As the police took over the stage and the hall, Douglas shouted, "Three cheers for liberty," as the opponent shouted, "Three cheers for Governor Wise." Later that night, the abolitionists reassembled at a black church on Joy Street in Beacon Hill to remember John Brown and honor free speech. Perhaps with a clean shirt, Douglas again was a key speaker. For the first time in nearly 8 years, by his own account, he appeared on the same platform with old Garrisonian comrade Wendell Phillips. Douglas announced hearty agreement with Phillips that all methods of proceeding against slavery should be used, including the John Brown way. With John Brown Jr. in attendance at the small church, and with a large crowd outside trying to get in, Douglas preached in favor of violence and war. They needed to keep all slaveholders in fear of personal danger, Douglas pronounced. I rejoice in every uprising at the South among slaves. Douglas even drew from Old Man Brown's crowd-pleasing poetic, if faulty, military idea. There is liberty in yonder mountains, in the Alleghenies, 1,000 men scattered in those hills, and slavery is dead. Feeling the spirit after that day's mob attack, Douglas called for an American Garibaldi to march into the South and summon to his standard 60,000, if necessary, to accomplish the freedom of the slave. Unfortunately, in a little war already breaking out in Boston, white mobs dogged Wendell Phillips on his path home, threatening his life. Several blacks, while leaving the church around 10:15 p.m., were assaulted, and some seriously injured. Douglas, the war propagandist wishing for blood and disunion, retreated from the former anti-slavery citadel of Boston, unharmed. In late December 1860, Douglas welcomed the news of South Carolina's secession from the Union. Heaping scorn upon the Palmetto State's rash act, as well as relishing it as an opportunity, Douglas all but thanked the secessionists for preferring to be a large piece of nothing to being any longer a small piece of something. Secessionists had resharpened his wit. They provided what he initially hoped would be the long-awaited opening for his cause, disunion, political crisis, and some form of sanctioned military action against the South, and therefore against slavery. He would get his wish, but only through the confusion and fear of the secession winter of 1860-61. Her people, South Carolina's, Douglas declared with anxious glee, except those of them held in slavery, which are more than half her population, have hailed the event as another and far more glorious 4th of July, and are celebrating it with plenty of gunpowder, bad brandy, but as yet no balls, except those where perfumed ladies and gentlemen move their feet to the inspiring notes of the fiddle. With no veiled intent, Douglas wished for a fight. Other balls may yet come, and unless South Carolina shall retreat, or the federal government shall abdicate its functions, they must come. Douglas had dreamed of this kind of moment, Events that could dislodge history from its worn paths and move it in new directions. In editorials, he lampooned what South Carolinians imagined as peaceful secession, celebrated by bonfires, pyrotechnics, music, and dancing. He cautioned Carolinians over their confidence about a thing easily done, so he maintained, they believed, as the leaving of a society of odd fellows or bidding goodnight to a spiritual circle. Excitement over secession in South and North, according to the editor, tilted from an undercurrent of doubt, uncertainty, distrust, and foreboding. Then he delivered a historical and constitutional analysis of secession. South Carolina was out of the Union, argued Douglas, only on paper and in resolutions and telegrams. Governments rest not upon paper, but upon power. They do not solicit obedience as a favor, but compel it as a duty. Douglas, the sudden American nationalist, acknowledged the right of revolution for a state or a political group, but no constitutional right of secession. A state could not secede. It could revolt. Revolution in this country is rebellion, and rebellion is treason, and treason is levying war against the United States with something more than paper resolutions. There must be swords, guns, powder, balls, and men behind them to use them. Secession was no abstract debate over federalism or states' rights, no issue resolved merely by ordinances, but a matter of power and guns. The right of South Carolina to secede, declared the angry but thrilled abolitionist, depends upon her ability to do so and to stay so. 20 years of pent-up personal travail and abolitionist struggle now flowed through Douglas's pen in Rochester. He believed, as many reasonable Americans have ever since, that the significance of any exercise of states' rights doctrine is in the issue for which it is employed. To Douglas, civil war was frightful, but by January and February 1861, he cast the prospect in positive and apocalyptic language. The God in history everywhere pronouncing the doom of those nations which frame mischief by law, he declared, had caused a concussion against slavery, which would now rock the land and sends us staggering about as if shaken by an earthquake. National will and institutions have not solved the problem. If there is not wisdom and virtue enough in a land to rid the country of slavery, then the next best thing is to let the South go, and be made to drink the wine cup of wrath and fire, which her long career of barbarism and blood shall call down upon her guilty head. Highly polemical, not always attuned to the nuances and divisions among the Republicans, nor to the scale of unionism in parts of the divided South, and filling his own cups of wrath, Douglas wanted the clarity of polarized conflict. He wanted war. Perhaps his greatest fear as the secession crisis unfolded was the potential for concession and compromise. For a former slave, and then an orator and an editor, whose political consciousness had awakened with the Mexican War and the Compromise of 1850, who had seen the fate of the slaves bandied about in one political crisis after another, and who had struggled to sustain hope in the face of the Dred Scott decision's egregious denials, a resolute stand by the North against secession and the slave power was hardly a sure thing. The best hopes of blacks, Douglas said that winter, had always been dashed by the old medicine of compromise. As he observed resolutions and conventions intended to settle the crisis, he complained that secession's enablers, North and South, had filled the air with wines of compromise. Compromise proposals came into Washington from all quarters of the North. Some were resolutions passed at pro-compromise union meetings, and some were the petitions of committees of industrialists eager to sustain their Southern commercial ties. All politicians were wary of the wrath and fears of their constituents and fervent to preserve the Union. On December 18, 1860, John J. Crittenden of Kentucky introduced the most comprehensive of the compromise initiatives, a series of constitutional amendments that blanketed the range of conciliatory measures. The debate over the Crittenden Compromise and others like it paralyzed Congress during the entire interregnum and secession winter. Douglas feared compromise for good reason. 30 years of anti-slavery agitation and its meager gains, as well as the very meaning of the Republican Party, were at stake. Attended by delegates from 21 states, although none from the Deep South, and sponsored by the Virginia legislature, a peace conference convened in Washington on February 4, 1861. After 3 weeks of confusion and negotiation, the uninspired gathering reported a compromise proposal nearly identical to that of Crittenden. No compromise measures ever passed the divided Congress. Week after week of wrangling gave evidence that most Democrats, but only a handful of Republicans, were willing to appease the South and extend the life of slavery in order to save the Union. As 6 more of the cotton states joined South Carolina and bolted the Union by early February, most Republicans across the North had resolved to prevent any conciliation. Most northern state legislatures also refused to support compromise. Only New Jersey formally endorsed the Crittenden Plan, which was a set of one-sided concessions to the South. Douglas observed the secession crisis with a combination of excitement and dismay. At least until late February, he believed the prospect for a major compromise to be real. He simply did not yet trust the will of the Republican Party and its president-elect, Lincoln. Discouraged, he complained that the state of the abolitionist cause was somewhat gloomy and dark. Abolitionists had plied the national heart and conscience with sound doctrine, but they seemed as far from accomplishment of their work as during the pro-slavery mobs of 25 years ago. Plenty of new mobs raged in the present. In January in Rochester, a convention of abolitionists meeting in Corinthian Hall was attacked by a violent crowd. The abolitionists reconvened at the Spring Street AME Zion Church to complete their meeting, out of which developed a series of weekly Sunday lectures organized by Douglas that lasted throughout the secession crisis. Uncertain of whom to trust or on whom to turn his anger, Douglas felt an acute sense of powerlessness as the Union dissolved. He feared that secession would become a struggle only over the survival of the Union and not over slavery. What disturbs, divides, and threatens to bring on civil war and ruin this country, he pled in February, but slavery? Only the morally blind, he argued, could fail to see it. What Douglas dreaded most was that a great opportunity to strike a lasting blow for black freedom might forever be lost through peaceful reconciliation. So he braced for the worst and anxiously awaited the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln. By March, Douglas seemed well aware that his fondest hopes were at the mercy of events. He knew the secession crisis was a test of power. Whether it resulted in war depended upon the reaction of the incoming Lincoln administration, which to him represented the one ray of hope amid the darkness of the passing hour and the reign of doubt and distraction. But by early April, Douglas was anything but confident that coercion against the South would ever truly come. He could only feel despair. All talk of putting down treason and rebellion by force, by our demoralized government and people, he agonized, are as impotent and worthless as the words of a drunken woman in a ditch. He still expected schemers to reach a deal. And so he imagined a future where abolitionists would have to attack slavery in a separate, independent country, and their work would take revolutionary turns. Then, as of old, he reached for desperate hope in a logic of violence. Faith, strained against unpredictable daily events and a volatile politics he could only dimly discern, these were the sentiments of a man observing a revolution, the directions of which he could not control. But then, the startling turn of events caused by the bombardment of one island fort in Charleston Harbor changed everything. By April, in Rochester, lecturing at the Spring Street AME Zion Church, where he had done so nearly every week during the past 2 months, Douglas spoke for his community. I have never spent days so restless and anxious. Our mornings and evenings have continually oscillated between the dim light of hope and the gloomy shadow of despair. We have opened our papers, new and damp from the press, tremblingly, lest the first line of the lightning should tell us that our national capital has fallen into the hands of traitors and murderers. The secession crisis took an enormous emotional toll on Americans of every persuasion. The only thing foggier than war itself can be the path to its frightening, if too often exciting, outbreak. Douglas ached for the event that would relieve the emotional tension and teach the world a new history. Chapter 17. The Kindling Spirit of His Battle Cry. The human heart is a seat of constant war. Frederick Douglass, June 1861. More than a century and a half after Appomattox, surveying the landscape of horror and mass destruction that modern war has wreaked upon the human species, reasonable people pause in examining those leaders in the past who have been bold advocates of war, as well as the creators of hated enemies targeted for attack and elimination. The willingness to kill and the desire to urge others in organized armies to kill for a cause are both primal and historical, personal and ideological. By the spring of 1861, Frederick Douglass yearned for war. His long rehearsal as a war propagandist had reached its final stages. As the poet Paul Laurence Dunbar suggested in a eulogy in 1897, Douglass, as much as any Northern partisan in the Civil War, kindled a battle cry of freedom. He dared the lightning in the lightning's track, and answered thunder with his thunder back. We weep for him, but we have touched his hand, and felt the presence of his magic nigh. The current that he sent throughout the land, the kindling spirit of his battle cry. Douglass welcomed the outbreak of the Civil War in April 1861 with a combined spirit of relief and rage. He was not a warrior himself, as he had discovered in his struggle with John Brown, but he was more than ready to wield his pen and voice to send millions to destroy slavery, slaveholders, and anyone shouldering arms in their defense. The contest must now be decided and decided forever, Douglass demanded in March 1861. Which of the two, freedom or slavery, shall give law to this republic? Let the conflict come and God speed the right. In May, after war had begun, he rejoiced. For this consummation we have watched and wished with fear and trembling. God be praised that it has come at last. For Douglass, the road to war had been emotionally and intellectually crooked. With great anticipation, he awaited President Lincoln's inaugural address, a historical moment dominated, said Douglass, by fear that the government had been allowed by the previous Buchanan administration to float to the very verge of destruction. On February 18th, Douglass joined a throng of 15,000 people who gathered at the Rochester train station to get a glimpse of Lincoln as the president-elect passed through on his storied whistle-stop journey to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. Douglass did not record whether he waved and cheered the Illinoisan as he stepped out on the rear balcony of the presidential train, or whether Douglass merely reflected with anxiety on the festive occasion. Under threat of assassination, and with military preparations minimal and unstable, Lincoln entered Washington in secrecy, and in the dark of night, only a few days before the March 4th inauguration. Douglass exploited the ironies for all they were worth, writing, "Mr. Lincoln entered the Capitol as the poor, hunted fugitive slave reaches the North, in disguise, seeking concealment, evading pursuers by the Underground Railroad, not during the sunlight, but crawling and dodging under the sable wing of night." Douglass welcomed Lincoln to the status of fugitive slave. Lincoln's speech, however, was a disappointment to the abolitionist. Lincoln's olive branches for the South were to Douglass so much weakness, timidity, and conciliation. He judged the address a double-tongued document for its declarations of support for the right of property in slaves in the existing slave states, and especially for Lincoln's quoting of the original Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution, and his promise to enforce all lawful efforts to return fugitive slaves to their owners. To Lincoln's cautious rhetorical and legal gestures to the South, Douglas responded with outrage, and as a former fugitive slave. Instead of meeting the South's revolution with honest rebuke, charged Douglas, the president served up palliations and apologies. As harsh as he could get, Douglas accused Lincoln of telling the slaveholders what an excellent slave hound he is, and how he regards the right to recapture fugitive slaves a constitutional duty. Douglas did grudgingly acknowledge the president's vehement rejection of secession as the essence of anarchy and assertion of the Union as perpetual. Douglas demanded, however, that Lincoln not argue with secessionists or parley with traitors, but fight them. He denounced the new president as the most dangerous advocate of slave hunting and slave catching in the land. Such was the beginning of the difficult, if eventually historic, relationship between Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. A discouraged, even floundering Douglass all but reversed one of his long-standing positions by the spring of 1861. He considered emigrating from America. The Scottish-born abolitionist, former supporter of John Brown, and peripatetic radical James Redpath had been leading a campaign for African-American emigration to Haiti since early 1860. Douglas not only ran frequent advertisements for the company, but warmed to the idea himself by early 1861. In January, he declared that he could raise no objection to the Haitian emigration movement, his opposition to earlier schemes of relocation to West Africa notwithstanding. The Republic of Haiti was in the Western Hemisphere, closer for Black Americans to their cousins enslaved in the United States, and officially welcoming immigrants. For once, Douglas maintained, the Haitian alternative might provide a means for some emigrating without appealing to our enemies for the means of getting out of the way of their hatred. Further, it meant that Blacks were not conceding that Africa is our only home, and that we have no right to remain in America. Douglas despised the idea of emigration when it merely confirmed the racist notion that Blacks and whites could never live together in equality. For a time, Haiti seemed to provide a means of still detesting colonization as fashioned by white enemies, while acknowledging a basic human right to leave for better climes. That winter, he gave his best wishes to 12 Rochester African-American families who followed their Baptist minister in moving to Haiti. By March, Douglas accepted emigration if driven by the human motives for better food, clothing, property, education, manhood, and material prosperity, and not by the charms of a colored nationality. With his own brand of romance about the history of the Haitian Republic born in Black Revolution, Douglas became a qualified emigrationist in the troubled secession winter. He was deeply worried for the safety of Northern free Blacks, and even more about the new insurrectionary rumors and tensions emanating from the South. "The United States is in great trouble," he announced. "Slavery, vengeance, and settled hate frown and threaten the free colored people." He warned that no one could any longer tell where pro-slavery mobs would strike next. They had become contagious since his violent encounter in Boston in December. The disorder has traveled like the cholera from east to west. In the Monthly, Douglas announced that, with his daughter Rosetta, now 22 years old, he had booked a steamer for April 25th, embarking from New Haven, Connecticut, and at the invitation and largesse of the Haitian consulate in Philadelphia to visit the island nation. Redpath had brokered the arrangements. What Douglas did not say is that he might have been traveling as a threesome. Odalie Ossing announced in her own column in Morgenblatt that she, too, was making plans to take a trip to Haiti in order to learn by direct encounter about the conditions in this Negro Republic. Whether Douglas and his German friend made these travel plans together for romantic reasons, as her biographer suggests, is dubious. Why would he invite Rosetta to join them? Possibly, Douglas entertained the fantasy of escape in this tense political atmosphere. Asking his smart but volatile and restless adult daughter, however, to share the trip seems incongruent at best. Douglas was surely capable of embodying and living such contradictions, perhaps even quite publicly at times. Ossing and Rosetta knew each other well by then from the ladies' summer visits to Rochester. But as always, Ossing is our only source for these plans and motives. Whatever alternative futures